Think is made possible by Guaranty Bank, Perot Systems, Southwest Securities, and the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Where would U.S. foreign policy be without the tug of war between those who would base every decision on ideology and those inclined to act purely out of self-interested pragmatism? My guest today hopes the next presidential administration will move beyond both of those extremes in order to make the U.S. safer without ignoring the needs of the rest of the world. C.M. Brown is the John Goodwin Tower Distinguished Chair in International Politics and National Security at SMU. His new book is called Higher Realism, A New Foreign Policy for the United States. C.M., welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Let's start by talking about the difference between what you call conventional realism and higher realism. What makes higher realism more effective?
It's not necessarily more effective unless it has the kind of sponsorship and backing that sometimes is lacking in the policy community. For example, today we have expectation that we're going to have a team of tough-minded realists or pragmatists directing U.S. foreign policy and national security policy. And I think that the president-elect has deliberately picked these individuals because they have that kind of a reputation. Now, what's harder to put into the mix of foreign policy is vision. Pragmatism for what? Okay, realism for what? And that's where I think a lot of work has to be done. And often there needs to be courage at the highest levels to push things in the direction of vision without worrying about that it might perhaps by some people be called naive.
So one of the things that you say is really important is understanding all of the different spheres that play into foreign policy and international relations, including the ones that overlap. Can you talk about what those spheres are and how we prioritize?
Well, very many interests are involved in foreign policy. Foreign policy is supposed to advance something called the national interest, but the national interest is a collection of all kinds of special interests. These have to be reconciled in order to advance the basic well-being and security of the country. And on the world scene, you have clashing national interests that complicate the ability of a country like the United States to get its way in the world. You have now, particularly after the Cold War, your friend on one issue may be your adversary on another issue. You're dealing not only with powerful nation states, but you're dealing with private entities. You're dealing with networks of terrorism. You're dealing with multinational corporations. You're dealing with a whole conglomerate of various interests. Some are state interests, but some are non-state interests that you need to reconcile or at least fend off in order to pursue this complicated thing called the national interest.
What's the difference between what's good for the United States and what's good for the rest of the world?
What's good for the United States is not always good for the rest of the world. But what is good for the rest of the world is almost always good for the United States. The United States is so intertwined, inextricably intertwined, with what's happening in the world at large that our national interests are becoming almost identical with world interests today.
So does that mean sacrificing some of the things that we have decided are important for us, regardless of how they affect everyone else?
I don't think that the need is to sacrifice what is good for us or this community, that the United States of America. The art of statecraft that we're looking now toward Obama to practice deftly is to reconcile what is good for the world with what is good for the United States, to pursue world interests that simultaneously serve national interests.
So do you think the Obama administration seems poised to err on the side of conventional realism?
As yet, it appears that that's going to be their immediate preoccupation. That there are needs not only in the financial sector, but in the international sector of policy for what are called bailouts in the financial sector. You know, the bailout is an interesting metaphor. It's like you have to bail out your boat to stop it from sinking, and that's your preoccupation. Whereas what may be needed also is a new construction, a new kind of boat. And internationally now, as well as domestically, we are preoccupied with controlling the damage in Iraq, in Iran, in Afghanistan. And these preoccupations, it appears to me, are going to take focus off of some of the larger world interests that we should be paying attention to and serving at the same time.
So how do you manage charting a new course at the same time you're repairing the damage to the boat?
That's very tough. here is where you hope that the president can keep his eye also on those larger accomplishments that that are needed, as well as bailing out the boat. I think we have some hope that Obama, who was also a vision man as well as a realistic pragmatist, will save for himself some time, some reflection, to make sure that the larger world interests that are also in the national interest of the United States are being pursued while we're doing this damage control.
One of the places that you think that American foreign policy really has gone wrong is since the end of the Cold War, we have had this idea of ourselves as a superpower. A lot of people would argue that there's no way around that, that that's what we have been. But what's wrong with looking at ourselves as a superpower and sort of framing our position within the world from that position?
I think there's a difference between recognizing that you are a superpower and therefore necessary for things to be accomplished in the world, for various world interests to be pursued, for global public goods to be pursued. Without the United States, these won't happen. There's a difference between that and what I call the 00 fallacy, the fallacy of omnipotence, and as well as the fallacy of omniscience, that we know more than we really do. We have great power, but we're not omnipotent. We have some wisdom because we've designed the kind of society here that seems to work, but we don't have the kind of wisdom that permits us to go around the world and to insist that other people follow our way, that we've somehow figured out the answer to the very complicated questions of how people should live with each other. So the difficulty is acting as a superpower, but acting in a way that doesn't turn others off because of our arrogance that we are also omniscient. And I think that's where we've erred in the past, in the recent past, and it's turned people against us.
So the response from some people to having looked at ourselves as omniscient was to look at the world as a multipolar system of governments. Mm. You actually want to go beyond that for higher realism and consider the world a polyarchy.
Yes. The polar metaphor doesn't work in today's world. I mean, a pole is something that has magnetic attraction. Okay. During the bipolar period, yes, the world had us as a magnetic attractor of countries that believed essentially in freedom, and the Soviets had their own pole of attraction. Now that the Soviets are out of it, for a while we flirted with the idea that it was a unipolar world, but it didn't really turn out that way. Iraq, of course, being a exhibit A as to that it didn't. But a lot of people are attracted by the notion that, well, okay, we're not unipolar, we're not bipolar, but we're multipolar. Is that really so? No country in the world today is able to be that kind of a magnet to attract others into its orbit. Okay. The Russians can't do that. The Chinese can't do it. If the Chinese try to act as the dominant or hegemonic power in Asia, they would offend the Indians, they would offend the Japanese, and a lot of smaller powers don't want that either. Most countries in the world today are attempting to diversify their relationships with other countries rather than being camp followers, rather than being permanent allies. This is the nature of the world that we're living in today, rather than multipolar, which suggests that there are a few regional poles of attraction. In every region, be it Latin America, Africa, South Asia, Southeast Asia, East Asia, our own hemisphere, you don't really have those poles of attraction. You have powerful countries, but the other countries don't want to be part of a polar system. They want to have the flexibility to operate on their own, to pursue their own national interests.
So how do non-state entities play into a polyarchic system, corporations and NGOs?
Well, they are actors on their own who increasingly are empowered to do things across national boundaries and are not that easily mobilizable by the nation states in which they might have their home offices. This is a feature of the contemporary world. Non-governmental organizations, non-governmental institutions and movements have a great deal of power on their own. And this has to figure into our view of how statecraft is to be conducted. We can no longer assume that just because a major corporation exists within the United States, that it is going to do things which are in the national interest of the United States. They will have their own profit line that they're attempting to maximize, and if the factors of production make it possible for them to produce things more cheaply in another country because there are not that many environmental laws and not that many laws that protect labor with safety standards and so on, they will locate in other countries. We can complain about that, but that's the nature of their freedom to move and their empowerment. But also smaller groups are able to empower themselves, sometimes in dangerous ways. There is a very open arms bazaar that they can purchase all kinds of weapons, lethal weapons, in order to pursue their own interests, like Al-Qaeda does. That's the nature of the polyarchic system, that you are dealing with a very volatile, kaleidoscopic changing of alliances, of adversary relationships, and foreign policy has not yet, U.S. foreign policy has not yet adequately adjusted and adapted to that reality. Now, that reality, of course, complicates the need to pursue certain world interests in international public goods because it's very difficult to mobilize collective action. And here is where the fact that the United States remains a superpower is where the mission of the United States in this post-Cold War era ought to be concentrated, and that is building incentives for cooperative action in this very complicated polyarchic world.
Going back to this idea that what is good for the rest of the world is very often good for the United States, in the past, recent past, our efforts to improve the rest of the world have often leaned toward creating Western-style economic systems and Western-style democracy in places that hadn't had them in the same ways before. How do we reconcile our belief that this is indeed the best sort of system because it works for us with the need to adapt it to the reality in the rest of the world?
I think one of the interests that we ought to be pursuing, one of the world interests that we ought to be pursuing, is a world in which cultural diversity is respected. Cultural diversity also translates into a variety of political systems, a variety of economic systems. That kind of a world in which there is mutual respect for diverse experiments in how humans should live with each other can be a more peaceful world than the world that we have been living in. So I think that although we do have grounds for believing that a market democracy, somewhat on our model, is one of the best forms of government. Others have to come to that on their own rather than being compelled to come to that. And what they finally develop as their own form is, if it's to be successful, is going to have to be congruent with their own historical traditions, with their own culture. This is something that I think we are having a hard time learning in the world. We had a difficult time in Vietnam learning that. We're having a very difficult time in Iraq learning it. And we're going to have, I think, a continuing difficult time in Afghanistan also for learning to respect cultural diversity and the various forms of political association and economic systems that that brings forward.
Sam, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Chris.
The new book is called Higher Realism, A New Foreign Policy for the United States. Just ahead on Think, staring down the holidays with one very cranky elf. We'll talk to actor Nye Cooper about the Santaland Diaries at Contemporary Theater of Dallas. First, take a look at this week's arts calendar.
The Art and Seat calendar for your first weekend in December features family-friendly seasonal offerings, Posters on Parade in Waxahachie, and gallery talent galore. At Art Space 111 in Fort Worth, the talents of 13 cutting-edge Dallas artists can be seen in the show Digital Divide, represented by UT Dallas's Central Track and curated by Mary Benedicto. Make your way to the Webb Gallery in Waxahachie for Sunday's opening of the Higher Power poster show, along with new work by Dan Phillips and opening day music from the Theater Fire. For Christmas fun on the kooky side, Theater Arlington takes a detour to the town of McCord's Ferry and introduces you to an oddball assortment of characters in the family-friendly spoof Fruitcakes, directed by B.J. Cleveland. And for a toe-tapping entree into the holiday season, Jubilee Theater in Fort Worth invites you out for Uncle Does Christmas, an original musical based on their other family favorite, Auntie Explains Xmas. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org, a new website for the arts in North Texas. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
If feel-good holiday specials make you queasier than day-old eggnog, Contemporary Theater of Dallas may have just the antidote. They're staging a one-man show based on David Sedaris' Santaland Diaries, and actor Nye Cooper is here to talk about playing the unemployed writer forced into the role of Crumpet the Elf for an entire tortured season. Nye, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
For those who have not seen this, will you give us a sample of the show?
I sure will. I manned the Oh My God corner. We were packed. We were absolutely packed, and everyone seemed to stop me with a question. Which way to the down escalator? Which way to the elevator? The patio restaurant, gift wrap, trim a tree? There was a line for Santa, and there was a line for the women's restroom. This one woman, having asked me 1,000 questions already, got up in my face asking, which is the line for the women's restroom? And I shouted that I thought it was the line with all the women in it. She said, I'm going to have you fired. I had 3 people say that to me today. I'm going to have you fired. Go ahead. I'm wearing candy cane leggings and velvet knickers. It doesn't get any worse than this. Who do these people think they are? I'm going to have you fired. And I wanted to lean over and say, I'm going to have you killed.
In case it's not immediately obvious, we should point out this is not a show for children.
It is not a show for children.
Do people always know what they're getting when they show up?
Not always. Most people who come out to see the piece, they're Sedaris fans, so they're well acquainted with his work. They know this piece from NPR. They know Santaland Diaries. Some people look at the postcard. They see someone dressed as an elf, an adult. Oh, great, we'll bring the kids. And they're not all, you know... It's not really for the kids.
Well, I guess older, you know, teenagers would be fine.
Teenagers who are very bitter and angry at the world love this piece.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a few of those to go around.
Yeah, there are a few.
But you know what's interesting, though? You're playing this guy who is not jolly about Christmas. He's not happy to be there. But there's a sweetness to him because he sort of identifies, or he's always noticing the people who are sort of caught up in this whole thing and not treated very well by the holiday.
Right. The piece, it's an observation. It's not like, you know, oh, and today this happened, oh, and today that happened. It's more of like, okay, today you're not going to believe what I saw. And today, oh, these people came in. You know, it's like that. It's not just a mopey, bitter piece. It's about, it's observing, you know, how different people handle the holiday season. Some people don't handle it so well. Some better than others.
Talk about your costume.
My costume. Well, like the piece said, it's green. I wear red and white striped tights, a pair of green velvet knickers, a green velvet smock, and a stocking cap decorated with red and gold. I've got shoes that are about like this that curl up on the ends with little green pom-poms on them.
As an actor, do you love that because it really just works?
I do. Mm-hmm. I do. I love the reaction the costume gets. I change on stage. So I try to stay hidden behind the chair as long as I can before I come out and, you know, people see, you know, the arms coming out. So, you know, it gets little giggles and people sitting on the side see. But, you know, it nothing is better than when you step out from behind the chair and, you know, people see, get the full effect and it gets the laugh. And I do love that.
When it's just you out there on stage, I'm sure that there are places where you know, wait for it, there's a laugh coming. But you, I guess every single audience, you must have to learn to read.
Every audience is different. Every audience is different. Sometimes things get a huge laugh. Sometimes people think, oh, that's awful, that's inappropriate, I shouldn't laugh at that. Sometimes it's uncomfortable laughter, you know, which is my favorite. But
how long does it take for you to know, oh, this is that audience, or they're going to do this?
I can usually get them in the first, about the first 5 minutes. I know what kind of audience I got. And then sometimes it's that audience where it's just like, okay, we'll just speed this along and get through it as quickly as possible.
Does it feel to you, do you ever have the character in your head when you're sort of walking through the rest of your life?
Constantly. Mm-hmm. Especially at Christmas time when I'm trying to do Christmas shopping and I'm trying to get through the stores myself. And, you know, when I pass the Santas, you know, in the Galleria or at North Park or, you know, wherever I happen to be shopping that day. Or, oh, yeah, you see it.
Have you had anyone come to see the show that is a Santa or works in one of these ridiculous setups for the holidays?
Oh, yes. We've had quite a few. Yeah. There was an entire group from the Galleria that used to come to Addison and see it, and it was Santa, several elves, and they loved it.
Do you have a particular aversion to the holidays yourself?
No, I love it. Mm-hmm. I love Christmas. I do. I'm from South Louisiana, so... you know, when I drive the back roads when I go home. And one of my favorite yard displays that I pass, and I talk about it every year, is there's a Ford pickup, a 1976 Ford pickup on blocks in a mobile home, in the front of a mobile home. And there's a nativity in the back of the Ford pickup. And I love that.
What would Jesus drive?
Exactly. It's fantastic.
So you do have sort of a soft spot for...
Oh, I do. I love... I just do. I love
Christmas.
The lights. I love watching the children's faces light up. I really do.
Did your parents take you to see Santa Claus when you were a kid?
Yes, and I hated him.
Really?
I did. I was afraid of Santa until I was, you know, 20. I was deathly afraid of him.
So. Well, hopefully you're over that now.
Yeah, I'm getting there. I'm getting there.
Well, Nye, it's been great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure.
You can see the Santaland Diaries through December 28th at Contemporary Theater of Dallas. The Think page of KERA.org has information about today's guests and links to our free podcast. The show's email address is think@KERA.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us and have a great week.
That was great.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. By the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive. And by the valued support of KERA members. Thank you.